This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I am Stephen Hausman. I'm an assistant professor in the history department at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I'm your host for today's interview. And for this episode, I am speaking with Dr. Erica Basumek, who is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Basumek is the creator of the digital history educational software Cleovis and is the author of the new book, The Foundations of Glen Canyon Dam, Infrastructure of Dispossession on the Colorado Plateau, which just came out with University of Texas Press just earlier this year in 2023. Welcome to the New Books Network, Erica. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why don't we begin, as we always do on the show, by just hearing a little bit about who you are. Can you tell us a bit about your background? And I'm especially interested in what got you interested in history in the first place.
Okay. Thank you for that question. That's an interesting place to start. Historians always say all history is personal, so a little bit of personal background is always useful, I guess. I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah, both my parents have immigrant backgrounds. My father was an immigrant from Germany. My mother's family were Italian immigrants. This becomes actually an important part of the book, what my family's relationship to the place I wrote about was. I went to the University of Utah, then I got my PhD at Rutgers. And I think the thing that sort of sparked my interest in history was actually the history I was taught when I was in, you know, junior high and high school did not actually match the history, my family's history. So kind of two immigrant stories to the American West that didn't really resonate so much in what I was reading about, history wasn't super engaging, but what was really engaging was kind of history around the kitchen table where, you know, the older generations would sit around telling stories about, you know, migrating to the United States. My father and his family came in 1953, family of four with, everything that the family could hold, could bring in basically a few suitcases. Growing up in wartime Germany, there's a really interesting kind of religious history there where the LDS Church actually sponsored them to come to the United States and then found a sponsor for them in Salt Lake City, Utah. My grandparents had converted to Mormonism in 1929, so pre-war Germany. So they had a kind of long-standing relationship with the LDS Church. There's also interesting wartime stories about where LDS people fit in Germany during that time period. My father was not a convert to the LDS faith, so I grew up actually non-Mormon. He married my mother, family of Italian immigrants, and they had come to be coal miners in southeastern Utah. So hearing those stories about what it was like to live, you know, to move from Germany to the United States, to experience wartime, to immigrate from southern Italy, Calabria, basically, to southern Utah, all of these things kind of sparked my, you know, awareness that the past was really relevant and shaped people.
Often when I ask my guests that question, I get some sort of answer that is, you know, in some way kind of shaped like what you said, where people are realizing that the history that they're learning in school doesn't often match up with the history that they know. And it is, in fact, a very personal thing. So I think that that's the kind of origin story for a lot of historians, in fact.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I'm curious also, what brought you to the topic of this book? Why a book that is about Glen Canyon Dam and this region? And I'm curious in particular, since you talk a bit about this in the book itself, what's your personal connection to this place?
So my personal connection to that place, you know, kind of has multiple answers. So the first one is, my first book was called Indian Made Navajo Culture in the Marketplace, and it sort of tracked Navajo or Dene's engagement with the modern American marketplace through the production and consumption of Navajo or Indian-made goods. So rugs, jewelry, etc. And it's really an interesting history about how those goods became commercialized and prized by white American consumers and how their makers were sort of treated in relationship, and there were some kind of interesting ironies there. And as a result of that, doing that research, I spent a lot of time, you know, driving, doing research on the Navajo reservation and communities adjacent to the Navajo reservation, interviewing traders. And as I was finishing up that book, I was doing a final set of interviews in Page, Arizona, and I happened to call my dad on a research trip, and he said, "Oh, where are you?" And I said, "Oh, I'm at Page." And he's like, "Oh, okay, as you're leaving Page, I want you to drive over Glen Canyon Dam, and when you get there, call me." And so, you know, I drove to Glen Canyon Dam, and I'm a Western historian, so these, you know, big infrastructure projects were fascinating to us. I went to college in Utah during the late 80s and early 90s when Ed Abbey was all the rage. So I knew this environmental story of Glen Canyon Dam and how controversial it was. But then my father said, "Oh, your grandfather helped build that." And I had never heard that in all the stories around the kitchen table that I had heard. I never had heard that he had been an engineer on that project. In fact, shortly he immigrated to the United States in 53, and by 1954 he was working on the dam. He'd been an engineer by training in Germany. So for me, part of that, you know, was thinking about this place, in relation to, which I'd already been thinking about, in relation to the Navajo reservation. And if you've never been to the Southwest, Glen Canyon Dam sits on the Utah-Arizona border, and it is abutted by the Navajo Reservation and this town called Page, Arizona. So essentially, the dam was built on land on the Colorado River, alongside the Colorado River, and that was that the Navajo Nation had to cede back to the government in a land swap in order for that dam to be built. And so it kind of, you know, things just kind of merged together where my family's history, I had a direct link to the dam. It had been in my consciousness for a long time as somebody who was interested in water and the West and the environment. And then it intersected with my previous book and scholarship, and it got me thinking about the ways in which, while there were literally probably thousands of books on Glen Canyon Dam that have been written, maybe, you know, 1500 to 2000. I had never read anything about indigenous people's relationship to the dam, or if I had read it, it had been very cursory and very stereotypical. And so the idea for the book kind of came out of that, the intersection of those experiences and ideas.
Well, let's get into the book a bit. And why don't we start by just setting the scene a bit here? What are the kind of absolute basics that we should know about Glen Canyon Dam? Where exactly are we talking about? When was this thing built? Why was it built? And why does it matter?
Okay, so it's located on the Colorado River upstream from Hoover Dam. So there are two major dams. There are lots of dams on the Colorado River, but there are two major ones. So Hoover Dam was the first one that was built in the 1930s. And Glen Canyon is the second one. The dam was actually proposed in the late 1940s. Construction started in the 1950s, and it was finished in the mid-1960s. And the dam was kind of a brainchild. The story of the dam goes back all the way to the 20s when they were trying to figure out where the first major dam on the Colorado River would go. So the kind of basic things you need to know about it is this: it's the second largest, tallest gravity arch dam in the United States. It's has 5 million cubic yards of concrete. Went into building the dam, the construction of the dam. It's a hydroelectric dam. It provides water and energy to about 40 million people across the United States. So as far east as Nebraska, and as far west as California. So a lot of communities rely directly on the dam. The other big relevant thing that is important to this story is that the region is currently in a drought, so water is becoming an increased commodity. Even one big snow year, which we had last year, or one year, good year of precipitation, is not going to get the region out of this 100-year drought cycle that it's in. So the water in that Colorado River that is dammed up behind Lake Powell has become increasingly prized and precious as both a commodity and a resource to keep the region. Most of the water is actually used for agriculture, but to kind of keep the region alive. The other really important thing to set the scene for the dam, and I have already mentioned the Navajo Nation, that when the Colorado River Compact was signed, which was a compact between the seven states, the lower and upper basin states, when they signed this compact and they divided up the water of the Colorado River, they completely excluded all of the indigenous people who lived in the region and who had, even by right, treaty rights to the Colorado River, including Navajo Nation, the Paiute, and then all the other tribes, up and downstream as well. So those are just some basics that are kind of important to the overarching story of the dam.
And this is also a very old place in terms of human history as well. So what is the history of people in this part of North America? Who has lived here historically? Why does this place matter so much to these indigenous societies that historically have and still do call this place home?
That's an excellent question. And I will not attempt to answer for indigenous people, but I will give some basic background that is really important to understand. A lot of indigenous people in the region, the Navajo, the Hopi, the Ute, the Paiute, the Zuni, etc., claim the region of the Southwest as their homeland, their place of emergence, where they have been and lived since, in their, often a phrase that's used in indigenous cultures is since time immemorial. So since before there was a sort of time. There are tens of thousands of archaeological sites all throughout this region that demonstrate the long history of human habitation in the region. So the river is considered sacred. There are various mountains and geological features within the region that are considered sacred. the land itself is considered sacred, a cosmological homeland, an ancestral homeland, a cultural homeland, a political homeland for indigenous people. And so the book focuses primarily on the Ute, Paiute, and Navajo. So for those, all of those cultures have a claim to the area of the Colorado Plateau as an ancestral spirit and a spiritual homeland.
But like all of the American West, of course,
yes.
That's not the only history at play here, right? You have these overlapping peopled histories of this place. So can you talk a bit about the LDS history of this area? Maybe describe the history of indigenous dispossession during the kind of mid to late 19th century?
That's a really interesting question. So exactly right. Like all of the history of the West, and especially places with water in the American West, those places became very desirable, very desired by settlers. And LDS migrants were fleeing they were persecuted, and they were fleeing that persecution and moving, you know, sort of sequentially west. It's not exactly that simple, but they move essentially from, New York, Vermont, Missouri, Utah. And Brigham Young is the leader who essentially brings his flock or his followers to the Salt Lake City Valley. And when he's there, he kind of declares this is the place. And this is where they're going to settle. And it's a sort of famous moment in LDS history when they get to their Zion, right? Their spiritual homeland. Angelo Baca has an interesting phrase. He is a Navajo tribal historian and cultural studies professor at Rhode Island School of Design, RISD. He's a filmmaker. He has a great phrase that describes what happens in this case, and he says, displaced people displace people. So we have one group of displaced people, the LDS migrants, moving into a land already inhabited by indigenous people, Utes, Paiutes, Navajos, and they begin to displace them in a pretty systematic way. In their mind, it is not ill-intended, but the consequences are disastrous for the indigenous people. And they are really influenced by, ideas about race, about civilization that are circulating in American culture more broadly about where indigenous people fit. They come up with their own, they have their own theology about who indigenous people are, where they fit in terms of LDS ideas, in terms of the Book of Mormon, etc. And they use all of those ideas to fuel actions which, you know, ultimately displace indigenous peoples of their land. They don't consult really with indigenous people. There's a little bit of that. Mostly it's they, you know, and I do a very detailed telling of these kinds of stories in the book, where LDS settlers move into northern Utah, and then Brigham Young almost immediately sends settlers out to establish satellite colonies in up through Idaho and then down through Arizona to create was called by the LDS Church, even by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a Mormon corridor, a sort of a corridor, a safe corridor. They also sent missionaries to Hawaii, to California, etc. So really, you know, they were proselytizing throughout the region, but Brigham Young wanted these colonies to kind of protect the main colony in Salt Lake City. And so he sends people almost immediately to southern and southeastern Utah. And there they come into contact, like they do in northern Utah, with increasing numbers of indigenous people. They don't initially try to convert them. They do often trade with them. They think they've struck in some ways in the minds of the LDS settlers. You know, they say, can we settle here? The indigenous people, especially the southern Paiute, allow them to settle. The Paiute don't understand that they mean permanently. So there are lots of cases where interactions between LDS settlers and Utes and Paiutes go something along the lines of, can we settle here? Yes, but don't bring any more people here. And the LDS settlers say, okay. And then they bring more people and it leads to tension, fighting, conflict, often death. So it's a kind of story that is very similar to what happens in across the entire United States. From the perspective of indigenous people, the indigenous people of the region are being, you know, white settlers are coming to Colorado, they're coming to Arizona, they're coming to Idaho, Montana, etc. They're sort of being surrounded on all sides by increased settlement. They've already experienced waves of settlement in New Mexico and Arizona of Spanish settlement. So they're not unfamiliar with what happens when newcomers arrive in their region. It just opens up a new era. This era of LDS settlement opens up a new era of that, of settler colonialism for, or settler colonization for them when it occurs.
So you have indigenous people who have been in this place since time immemorial, and then you have LDS settlers coming here in the mid to late 19th century. And then you also have the U.S. government, which emerges as another major player in this part of the Southwest. So what role does the U.S. government play in claiming this space for American settlers? And in particular, as we get into the early 20th century, I'm curious about the role of science and how new and emerging ideas about science kind of undergird a lot of the arguments that government officials and others are making in justification for taking this land?
Yes. Okay, so the LDS settlers are a little bit different than some other settler groups because they're actually in conflict with the U.S. government. And Brigham Young, one of the things he wants to do is to kind of use indigenous peoples as a buffer zone between the LDS church, who are practicing polygamy, and the U.S. government, who has outlawed polygamy. So Utah is initially its own territory, the Beehive territory. It's sort of its own nation. That quickly goes away. I'm shorthanding that entire history. And they outlaw polygamy. They become a territory, then they become a state. And as that is happening, as that process is unfolding, the government is sending not only military agents and Indian agents, but they're sending explorers. They're creating the USGS, the U.S. Geological Survey. They're creating the Bureau of American Ethnology. So there's a direct overlap between government efforts to shore up the white settlement of the American West, to survey the region's resources, which is what they're doing with the USGS. How much water is there? How much land is there? What kinds of minerals are there? Is there gold? Is there silver? Etc. How much water is there? And so they send people like John Wesley Powell, who is the sort of famed Civil War hero. He loses an arm during the Civil War, and then he, by the 1860s, late 1860s, is the first person to navigate the length of the Colorado River. He does it in, you know, a couple of different trips with a team in these wooden boats. The Colorado River is, you know, they call it the Mighty Colorado. It is formidable, it is dangerous, etc. And so John Wesley Powell goes out to survey the entire region. And while he's there, he comes into contact with indigenous people. He hires them to guide him across the country to figure out where they're getting potable water when they're moving across the desert, where to find food, how to get resources, etc. So the government is kind of complicit. Well, the government supports the settlement of the region, white settlement of the region, there's a little bit of animosity. Well, there's animosity between LDS settlers and the U.S. government. John Wesley Powell doesn't love the Mormons, but he loves their settlements. He talks effusively about the way that they're able to grow food in this harsh desert region, the way that they are irrigating their crops. He goes to a lot of these smaller LDS settlements and speaks very highly of them. But John Wesley Powell is also, you know, has ideas about how water should be used, and he doesn't actually think the nation's plan for moving water to people as opposed to moving people to water is the best plan. So the government actually plays a number of different roles. After John Wesley Powell, there are subsequent iterations of surveys across the region, especially the region of the Colorado Plateau, where various scholars, educators, scientists move throughout the region documenting, attempting to survey and document the region's resources. And whereas Powell worked directly with indigenous people, we start to see the erasure of their presence. And one really interesting thing about the whole settlement of the region and its relationship to both settlers and scientists is one of the first things that settlers do when they move into the especially arid regions of the plateau is they look for evidence of prior settlement or evidence of existing settlement, and then they look to see to how people either got their water or were getting their water, and then those are exactly the places where they chose to settle and displace people. So they literally sometimes build their settlements right on top of earlier indigenous settlements where there were already irrigation ditches or earth barrier dams, etc. And then they bring their own irrigating know-how, and they learn from indigenous people by studying the past to irrigate the region even further. So the scientists actually document the ancient irrigation channels, in their words. There's a sort of famous geologist, Herbert Gregory, who does a whole survey of what he names Navajo country. You know, he's naming the rock layers, he's naming the regions, he's collecting names of the region from indigenous people. So there's a whole bunch of exploration that goes on during this time period that's meant to shore up the white settlement of the region. That is its express purpose.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
And if I remember correctly, that's how the city of Phoenix, Arizona gets its name, is that it's the city that's kind of, in the words of the settlers, rising from the so-called ashes of the previous irrigated settlement that had been there before. But, you know, someone check me on that, because I'm just thinking off the top of my head here. But I'm pretty sure that it's a very similar story from another part of the Southwest as well.
Yeah, I think it's a story that happens frequently in the Southwest, mm-hmm. but it gets kind of, by the 1950s, the governor of the state of Utah, actually a man named George Dewey Clyde, he actually credits the settlers with being the first and best irrigators in the region. And, you know, if you are thinking through the lens of indigenous people and native history, or if you are an indigenous people, you know that indigenous people have been living and irrigating in that region for a long, long time. Like, you know, long before the white settlers arrived. So there's some, you know, there's a lot that we can unpack there.
we've been talking about water, and you know, we're talking about a dam, so of course water is really important to this story, and this is in many ways an environmental story and environmental history. Can you tell us a little about the ecology of the region? And maybe to contextualize this a bit, I'm wondering how American officials in the kind of early to mid 20th century, as people are beginning to eye potential sites for a dam in this region, how were they thinking about questions of ecology and aridity and water? And how can we compare this to the way that indigenous people are thinking about the land? That was a kind of a big unwieldy question.
Yeah, it's a big question. Let's see where it takes us. Well, the first, first thing we can think about is Powell. We'll start with the non-indigenous, and then we'll go to the indigenous views. Powell gets to the region, and I alluded to this earlier. Powell comes, he goes back. He draws a watershed map. It's a beautiful image. I don't know if you have images on your podcast, but it's one that you could include. But he draws a map, which is basically a watershed map, and he's like, "Look, we have configured the territories for the states in the West all wrong. We should configure them around watersheds in the region." And Congress is like, "Nope, we already drew those nice square lines. We're not going to build settlements around watersheds. We're going to engineer our way out of this problem." And by the early 20th century, they have created the Bureau of Reclamation, which has biblical overtones. Its name of reclaiming water has biblical overtones. And the idea is to reclaim the waters of the American West and move them to where people, white settlers, are moving to. So, they're thinking about the ecology of, or they're thinking about the environment of the West largely as an engineering problem to be overcome. How can we engineer our way out of the limitations of this particular environment? Indigenous people, the Navajo, the Paiute, the Hopi, the Zuni, etc., do engage in some engineering of their environments on a different scale, on a how do we get enough water for our community? How do we have enough resources for our community to feed our communities? How do we respect the environment so we are not radically, altering the flow of a river? You might divert part of the river into an irrigation ditch. You don't dam up the river. And as I was finishing up the book, I was having conversations with some of the, Navajo leaders within the community. And one of them, Mark Maryboy, said, "We never would have done that. We never would have dammed up the Colorado River. And in fact, it is the impeding of the flow of the Colorado River is actually one of the reasons why our community is out of balance." So the idea of living in balance with nature is a kind of guiding principle for indigenous people in the region. And it's one that is deeply undone by the actions of the white settlers, right? They view the environment as a resource to be tapped. Resources become commodities that can become bought and sold and can generate wealth for communities. And that's very different from how indigenous people were interacting with the environment.
So how does this project actually come together? Can you describe a bit about the process of designing and building the dam itself? And, so much of this is sort of about how people are thinking about these things. So I'm also curious, what does its construction mean for the various stakeholders involved? How are Indigenous people in the moment, at the time in this region, seeing and thinking about and viewing, engaging its construction? And then how are American settlers doing the same?
Okay, so there are the there's the practicalities of you have a whole team of engineers and scientists who survey the landscape. They figure out where to place the dams for maximum energy production. So there's that story, and lots of people have told that story. And that is the kind of dominant story of the dam. The thing that interested me was, in order for all those things to happen, for you to get engineers on the ground, for you to get lots of settlers moving to the region who would need these resources, to have this kind of growth mindset, if we build this dam, we can produce all this electricity, which can go to places like Phoenix, which means we can build more houses, which means more people can move to a place like Phoenix, which means we'll need more energy, which means we'll need, you know, so that that growth cycle. All of that is undergirded by a system and way of thinking, which I call infrastructures of dispossession. So the dam is not the only, the dam is a physical infrastructure that symbolizes these other metaphorical infrastructures of dispossession. So those would be the religious ideas underpinning the settlement of the region, both Christian and LDS, the whole idea of manifest destiny, and then LDS migrants moving into the region. So religion becomes a kind of justification for taking the land of indigenous people. So you have to have that piece in place. Then you have to have the government piece, the kind of political infrastructure in place that will send, you know, you have to have this body that has the both the financial and political will to remake the region in really fundamental ways for the purposes of the construction of the dam. So we have religious, political, scientific infrastructures, right? You have to have a burgeoning field of engineering. You know, Hoover Dam and Glen Canyon Dam are monumental features. They were the biggest, you know, that the work that went into building these dams, designing them, you know, is astonishing. The government is sending engineers on trips all around the world to look at these other infrastructure projects, these other dams, to see if we could build something like Hoover or Glen Canyon. And then they just do it, right? There are no environmental impact statements. There's no questioning whether or not this should be done. So that becomes an infrastructure of dispossession as well, that, you know, that sort of scientific knowledge. And all of these things kind of culminate in the construction of Glen Canyon Dam. And people at that time begin asking questions about the environmental impact of this dam. So should we be doing this on this scale? So Glen Canyon Dam is most famous for that, for the fact that David Brower and the Sierra Club really looked into, a little late, but they eventually got there, what this place Glen Canyon was, should it be dammed up, how would it change the region in terms of how would it change the water temperature, how would it change the ecology, how would it change all of these different things. This environmentalists do not involve the indigenous people right away. But one of my very favorite quotes from when I was doing research, and it's something that I always talk about with my students, is that this is the moment when people begin to question that growth mentality, that because we can engineer it, we should do it mentality. So David, or Richard Bradley, his brother David is also an activist, is a physics professor at Colorado College. And he, you know, gives a speech where he basically says, look, we could train engineers to drain the Atlantic Ocean, but we should also train them to ask, should we be doing that? And he makes this case that engineers and scientists who kind of come up with these things are basically policymakers, and their infrastructure is enacting policy in ways that completely remake regions. And so we also have, you know, indigenous people speaking out. Navajo Nation engages in that land swap. They give the federal government the land to build the dam. The government gives them promises about what they're going to get for participating in the construction of the dam. They're going to get jobs. They do get some jobs building the dam. They're going to get concessions. They don't get as many of those as they want. They're going to get water and electricity. They don't get those things to the extent that they think they're going to give them. Indigenous people have to navigate all of these infrastructures that are designed to dispossess them of their land throughout this whole process, and the deck is stacked against them. And that's why the final chapter in the book is really a court case, where it demonstrates that Indigenous people have fought, you know, if we think about this as kind of layers in the landscape, kind of geological layers, they're literally fighting against this foundation of dispossession and attempting to, through the courts, use the courts to protect their natural sites, their locations, their resources that are spiritually, culturally, and ancestrally significant to them. But to do that, they have to use the courts, and the courts get to go back. In the case that I look at, it's called the Bodoni case. And it's sometimes called the Rainbow Bridge case, where Rainbow Bridge is spiritually significant for Navajos, especially those living in around the Navajo Mountain area, which is adjacent to Rainbow Bridge. Rainbow Bridge is a national monument, but if you look at where it's at, it's, you know, right along the the borders of Glen Canyon National Recreation Area. It's right smack dab in the middle of that region where all this development is happening. And Navajo Nation is trying to, or residents from Navajo Nation are trying to get that protected from all this construction, from the waters. They don't want the waters of Lake Powell to back up under Rainbow Bridge. And, you know, they eventually form an alliance with environmentalists. Environmentalists do that right at the last minute. They pursue this court case, and the courts basically say, you don't have any legal rights to this because you don't have legal standing because this isn't your land. Well, if we go back through the historical records, it was their land, and even the federal government at different points recognized it was their land, but when it became a national monument, it was cut out of the Navajo reservation or the Paiute territory. It went back and forth between the two tribes without consulting Indigenous people. So the court gets to say, like, sorry, you don't have any standing. And then they say, well, we have freedom of religion. We've worshipped there for a long time. And then the judge in the case, whose name is Alden Anderson, who is the descendant of LDS settlers who moved into that region, who were the first people to settle, he says, well, you don't have a you don't have a religion. A religion would be you worship at this place at a, you know, the same time every single year or same times every single week. You don't have a seminary where you're training these individuals in these religious ceremonies. Therefore, you don't have a religion. So that's where religion comes in, as one of those infrastructures of dispossession that Indigenous people are, you know, it's embedded into our law. So each one of these layers of the infrastructure of dispossession is embedded into the dam, and the dam becomes symbolic of the white settlement of the region and the Indigenous dispossession of the region. That was a really long answer to that question.
That's okay. I'm asking really big questions.
Yeah, it was a big question.
So what are the politics of Glen Canyon Dam today and in the more recent past? I mean, you know, over the course of especially the late 20th century, you have all kinds of protests and movements and activism around questions of Native sovereignty and over land back. They're just growing louder and louder over the course of especially the second half of the 20th century and into the 21st century. So how does Glen Canyon emerge as sort of a central point or a nexus of a lot of these questions? What are, again, the politics of this in the early 21st and late 20th century?
So I think one of the interesting things is Glen Canyon Dam has really not necessarily emerged as a nexus for those political debates. I think it could be. and potentially should be. The way we see it come up most often is in terms of water. So who is going to get the water that's in Lake Powell? Will any of the 40 tribes who have treaty rights to any of the waters of the Colorado River be able to get their claim? The Supreme Court just heard a case from Navajo Nation about whether or not they were entitled to some of the water from the Colorado River because of a phrase about, you know, a guaranteed homeland. Interestingly enough, for everybody else, a homeland in the West meant the government was going to provide them with water, right? Which is how we got the dam. But when it comes to indigenous people, the Supreme Court basically decided that a homeland does not guarantee water. To have a home in the region does not necessarily guarantee you're going to have water in the region. So those water rights are, I think, you know, we know for a long time they've been the hot button point. They've been the, you know, the famous saying, whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting over about the American West. I think we're going to see a lot more fights culminate around water. There have been, the Navajo Nation is doing an amazing job training young scholars in both the ancestral knowledge about the significance of the water and making sure that there are scholars, there are scientists who understand how the watershed works, how the river works, and getting a seat at the table in these discussions. But even, you know, last year when it was the 100th anniversary of the Colorado River Compact, there were not a lot of indigenous people invited to the table to discuss the future of Glen Canyon Dam. There are places like Glen Canyon Institute that are doing a good job reaching out now to indigenous people and thinking about the future of Glen Canyon. It probably is not feasible to have two major dams on the Colorado River, Hoover and Glen Canyon. So there's always been a movement to drain Glen Canyon Dam. Ed Abbey and, you know, Dave Brower started that, you know, get rid of that dam. It's an unnecessary dam. It sullied, you know, one of the most beautiful places in the American West. Now that movement is really like, there's not a need for this dam anymore. One dam could, you know, would probably be enough for the region, but that region is going to have to change its ideas about water use and electricity. And of course, climate change is really complicating all of this. And indigenous people are incredibly vulnerable. They're often the last to get electricity. In the book, I chronicle that. Lots of the Navajo Nation does not have running water. They don't have access to running water. They, you know, truck in their water. So, you know, water is the, I think water is the kind of key here, and how indigenous people are fighting for and leading efforts to claim that water. And they're doing amazing, amazing things in that regard.
So as we begin to wrap up here, I always like to ask my guests to take kind of a different perspective on their book and to put themselves in the shoes of someone who has read their book or a reader of their book, and imagine that they are thinking back on this book from a remove of a year or 5 years down the road. What do you hope this reader would remember from this book or would come away understanding from this book a few years on down the line?
That's a good question. I think one thing that would be interesting for them, or one of the takeaways I hope they would have, is that you cannot tell the story of Glen Canyon Dam without telling the history of indigenous people in the region. That the dam is really representative of a kind of colonial mindset that didn't always have a place for indigenous people, and yet Indigenous people are in that place, right? So how have Indigenous people, how did they engage with the federal government? How have they attempted to control their resources? What are they doing now to draw attention to the, you know, their own concerns, their own culture, etc.? And I think for me, one of the most hopeful episodes in the book, it comes from the epilogue where, you know, I chronicle what an infrastructure of dispossession looks like. But I also say, you know, we can look at Bear's Ears, where Indigenous people came together, tribes that and nations that had traditionally not always gotten along with each other, came together, fought for the protection of a sort of sacred homeland, a land that they had, that these tribes had all used, petitioned the federal government for the creation of a national monument. That's very different from the federal government saying, we're going to put a national monument there and we're going to, now you no longer have access to it, or we're going to build this national park, or we're going to build this big infrastructure project. They argue for the creation of Bears Ears National Monument, and they have had a seat at the table from day one. And so even though the book, the dam kind of stands as a symbol to this era of settler colonialism, there are other models and other ways in which the government and the settler community and Indigenous people can come together and create more equitable spaces and equitable ways we manage the land. And so I think that's one of the big takeaways.
And then finally, I always like to get a preview from my guests about what they've been working on since the book's release. And sometimes it feels kind of silly because this book has been out for what, about like 90 days or something like that. It's a very, very hot off the presses book. But nonetheless, I know historians and we never just have one project going on at once. So I'm curious, Erica, what you've been working on while this book has been going to print and everything.
So I have two projects. Well, I have two scholarly projects and one pedagogical project. So I'm working on, so one of the figures in the book was a Navajo girl who was kidnapped by Utes in Marble Canyon, the region of Marble Canyon, and then she was traded to other bands of Utes, and then she was traded to soldiers at Fort Bridger, and then she was purchased or won in a card game by an LDS patriarch, and then she worked for the patriarch's family as an indentured servant for his first two wives in sequence, first one wife and their children and then the other wife. And then when she turned 18 and he was in his late 50s or early 60s, he married her. The church had outlawed polygamy. The other two wives rejected, I don't know, him for a variety of reasons, maybe because he married her. That's a little unclear. He seems to have become, you know, estranged from them prior to that. But he takes her to South Dakota and they mine gold, or they try to. And then they move back to southern Utah, to Vernal, Utah, and they actually get an allotment on the Ute reservation because the LDS community will not have him. And so that is a book, it's a kind of biography of her that I hope will be a short book, so 60,000 words, that we could use in classes because it kind of hits on all of the big issues in the American West and Native American history, you know, allotment, servitude, slavery, conflict, settlement, etc. So that book is called Unsettling Narratives, about Rose Daniels is her name, the woman's name, and it will focus on her. I have a big book, a big project that I've been working on for a really long time called The Concrete West, and that's about how concrete itself has been used to transform the environment of the American West. Concrete produces about, you know, 10% of CO2 emissions. So it's really an environmental history of the West and of concrete itself. And then I have a pedagogical project that I've been working on for the past couple of years, which is called Cleovis. And it is digital timeline, mind mapping, and network visualization software that any instructor can use in their classroom. It's really fun. It's a fun way for students or researchers to engage with their material, where you can plot an event on a timeline, or plot events on a timeline, but then the students can actually draw a connection between the two of them and explain that relationship. And then these timelines are fully interactive. They're illustrated. You can add audio to them. The students learn how to present with them. So it's a really fun pedagogical project. It's used in all sorts of universities across the United States right now, and I hope some people check it out.
Those all sound like fantastic projects. And you and I were talking a little bit about Cleovis before the episode began, and my mind was just racing with all the ways that I could use it in my own classes, my own American West class and everything. So I'm excited to do some experimenting with that myself this coming semester. So thank you for your work on that in particular.
Okay, thank you so much. Thanks for your great questions. They were really thoughtful, and this was a really fun interview.
Yeah, I agree. Dr. Erica Basumek is the author of The Foundations of Glen Canyon Dam, Infrastructure of Dispossession on the Colorado Plateau, which is just out with the University of Texas Press, came out earlier this year in 2023. Thank you so much for joining me today, Erica. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.